slash strategy of movement of like putting more of a spotlight on them for younger kids, basically, with doctors, schools, within the administration,
So
everything.
you're saying that there are schools where they do presentations and then go, "Hey kids, if you're not feeling good about your body, how about puberty blockers?" That's happening somewhere?
I wouldn't say that they would say puberty blockers in there, but say within schools, they're more or less, I guess, going into like gender identity and everything, and every sexuality and everything like that, which would bring the conversation moving towards that.
Do you have any evidence that in schools where they talk about the fact that trans people exist, they're pushing puberty blockers? Is there a single example of such a school?
I mean, wait, do like the w example where they're mentioning puberty blockers in like the teachers said the word puberty blockers.
Yeah, where they're saying not when issues of gender are taught in schools, where puberty blockers are being talked about by teachers and presented as something to pursue or something. You said, remember that at the beginning of the call, you said pushing. The word was pushing. I'm looking for someone pushing
I'm
it.
not saying again, I like I said, I don't think that they're like the teachers themselves are saying are pushing puberty blocker, like they're going and saying puberty blockers. I'm saying that the conver like the thought process and the transition to the end result with transitioning puberty blockers is in like you may not like pushing the whole idea. Again, I'm not I, if adult wants to make a decision, I'm not against anything adult wants to do. I'm saying kids specifically push an
No,
idea
Steve, I
younger
get
of
that,
like,
but you
oh.
started the call by saying that something is being pushed, and we've gone piece by piece, and you're acknowledging you can't actually identify anyone pushing it.
I mean,
Everyone I ask you, is this person pushing it? Is that person pushing it? You go, well, no.
so what
And
is
now you're
your
saying I'm not even saying it.
what is your definition of pushing it?
Promoting, encouraging.
Like, yeah, I mean the Biden administration is encouraging kids to
Okay, no,
be
but
able
no,
to use
Steve, now
puberty
we're back to the
blockers when
beginning.
they
That was
don't.
your first claim, which already fell apart. All right, Steve, thank you for the
No.
call. I'm going to let you go. By the way, I'm not even taking a position for or against puberty blockers for kids. Like, I don't know enough about it to say, maybe it's not a good idea. I'm not taking a position. That caller had no idea what he was talking about. Okay. Let's go next to Jim from Chattanooga. Jim, welcome.
Hi, David, a long time viewer. How are you doing?
Doing well.
I guess my question is how to reframe kind of basically the basic idea is there's going to be pain, and I think Democrats are struggling with this. Basically, a lot of the problems are right now that we're suffering from are from kicking the can down the road, and a lot of the solutions tend to have short-term sacrifice involved. How do we reframe that so people that are in their 60s who will never enjoy a working universal healthcare system are willing to make that sacrifice?
Well, this isn't really like a new thing that humans do. I mean, I think for most humans with a normal emotional landscape, the idea that we might do something that's good for the species we belong to, even if I won't personally benefit from it, is still a completely reasonable thing to do. I mean, the interstate highway system took a very long time to build, and many of the people that supported their tax dollars going to it didn't live long enough to enjoy it. And I mean,
Right.
it doesn't seem. I think the weird thing to me isn't why the weird thing to me would be that more people wouldn't, of course, understand that the way things are, some of the good things we have today, we have because people who didn't benefit from them were okay supporting them financially. And that as a result, we should do the same thing to keep improving society. It would be it, if we have to explain that to people, then we're in real trouble.
So you don't think the attitude around that has changed?
I think that it hasn't changed in terms of people's emotional understanding of it, but I do think that the political system we have, including these terms of 2, 4, and 6 years that don't really encourage long-term thinking. They encourage what can I do to justify my next re-election? That definitely is not good.
Right. And I think that's just a feature or maybe
Yes.
a bug, but yeah, of our
Absolutely.
current system. Thank you, David.
All right, thank you.
Maybe just one more thing. I'm
Sure.
getting a vasectomy next week, and I thought maybe you could comment on that. I'm 36, no kids.
That's interesting. You know, many urologists won't do a no kids vasectomy for people your age. What was the conversation like?
Well, I found one in Georgia, so I'll be traveling.
Oh, so you're admitting it was hard to find one. You had to go to find one in a different place.
Not just find one, David. Find one that's affordable, like under $2,000. It's not just it. If you don't have money, you can't just go. I don't know. People think that these things are just out there to go grab off a shelf somewhere.
But did you talk to urologists who said, you know, for someone in your situation, I don't really.
You've tuned into Pandemonium, a public affairs program with WSUT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed on the show are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs PA. At WRCT.org. And now, Pandemonium. Hello, my name is Thomas Garrison. I'm a math major, and I'm here interviewing Wes Pegden, professor of mathematics at CMU today. And my first question is, how do you choose problems to work on?
Oh, yeah, so that's a good question. So, math problems, I think, yeah. We come to them in different ways. I mean, sometimes there's a problem that people have been thinking about for decades, and it's been around for a long time that people have been curious about, and it's something that a lot of people want to solve. Other times, you have a problem that you comes up in some sort of application, where it would help you solve something else, and so you start thinking about the problem that way. But a lot of times there's just, problems were posed at some point and people got interested in them, and then they've been open problems for quite some time. And then it's this thing that people are interested in and understand.
Nice. Do you think about like math recreationally when you go home? Are you still thinking about math, or did it shut off?
Oh yeah. I think, I think you spend a lot of time thinking about math. Yeah, at unusual times when you're not really, you're kind of always, it's always sort of at least in the back of mind, some problem that you're working for. Especially, if you're really close to something, or you feel like, or there's one little thing that you're trying to fix about some proof, then it's hard to think about anything else.
Makes sense. What is your approach when you start a new problem? How do you start, I guess?
Oh yeah, so I mean that depends a lot on the problem, and also a lot on the person. Sometimes you're working in some field where where you've done a lot of work and you have a lot of tools that you're familiar with and a lot of techniques, and maybe just by the nature of the problem, you have some ideas about how to get started, and there are similar problems that where you have some idea of how they were solved. And other times you're doing something completely new. And it requires you to be much more exploratory and just, sort of pursue a much more open-ended process of just sort of trying to get an understanding of what's going on without really knowing, where that will lead you.
And how do you decide if you, need to, pull in other people, or do you usually, like to work alone or what?
That's an interesting question. I mean, sometimes... I think a lot of times people decide to work together on something because they sort of encounter the problem together. They're already discussing something and then here's this thing that we've done. But other times, it can also happen that you're working on something and you think, well, this is something where I don't really know some technique or some, background that would be relevant here. Maybe so-and-so can help me with this. So I think both of those things happen. I think the social aspect of this is very real, and that sometimes just discussing things with people will lead to will lead to the idea of trying to work out some problem, and that those people will work on it together.
Got it. What's the problem you worked on that is easy to explain?
Easy to explain. One problem that's in this category of things that come from some application that people are interested in is something related to political districting, right? So there's this topic of there's this topic of gerrymandering, political districting. So this is when the people that draw, for example, the congressional districting of Pennsylvania might carefully draw the districting to maximize the electoral advantage they get from that districting, right? So for example, if the Republican legislature of Pennsylvania was drawing the congressional districting in 2011, they might have drawn it to try to ensure that they get as many Republican seats as possible in the U.S. Congress in a delegation. And so gerrymandering, so claims of gerrymandering are often litigated, right? So there are sometimes lawsuits asserting that, you know, one political party has carefully drawn a political districting to maximize their advantage in this way. Now, when this happens, you know, there's a court case and evidence is presented and judges have to decide whether or not this really happened, right? Did the political party really maximize their advantage? Did they really carefully draw these lines for some political goal? And so one thing that's funny about this is, right, I mean, if you think about this in the abstract, you're presented with one map, and the question is this map fair or not? And, of course, usually to think about whether something is fair, you'd want to have some comparison. And so this is where math can come into play. So in particular, the natural question that arises mathematically from this problem is how one can generate truly random partitions of a geometric shape. So, for example, that geometric shape could be a state. And by geometric partition, we mean we want to divide the shape into a certain number of regions, each of which is a connected region, and each of which, in the case of a state districting, may have to have equal population in the state, and may have to satisfy some other geometric conditions. It's an example of a sampling problem, right? I have some complicated space, which is here the ways of dividing up a geometric shape into regions, and the problem is how can I generate a random sample from this space? So that's an example of something that we've done a lot of work on, and this is a good example of a problem that really came from an application, right? So there was this thing that people were discussing, which is how can we sort of get at the problem of evaluating these districtings, and that led to these natural questions about sampling.
Nice. And for problems like gerrymandering where it's applicable to the public, or problems that aren't applicable to the public, how do you try to make it like accessible to people?
Yeah, so okay, in the case of the math that was related to these gerrymandering problems, it's especially important because in particular there's some court case and a judge has to kind of understand what's going on, because they have to use this as part of their framework to decide what to think about the case. In the case of gerrymandering, for that reason, I spent a lot of time thinking about how to frame the procedure that we developed in simple terms, and even giving analogies and different ways of thinking about it, just to make it accessible. I mean, certainly, I don't think that I would never expect, you know, the proof of the theorem to be something that the court could understand, but I at least wanted the statement of the theorem to be something the court could understand. Right. And I think that's something that we managed to do.
For a less less grounded in like application problem, do you still try to make it accessible, and how would you do that?
So I think a lot depends on the audience for the problem. I mean, sometimes you're working on a problem that is going to really be of most interest to, you know, people working in some specialized field. And then, I mean, that's your target audience, and you're really writing it for those people. And other times you're solving a problem that you hope will be that will have wider interest. And yeah, I think you always think about, you think about who the audience is, and then you try to make what you're doing understandable and relatable to that audience. And who that audience is, you know, can be very different from one math problem to another.
That makes a lot of sense. How or when did you know you wanted to do math?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so I think I actually, as an undergraduate, so when I started as an undergrad, I wanted to do physics. And then I switched after a year to focusing on math. And I think, yeah, so the main reason is that I think, in high school in the United States, math is generally not taught very well in most most schools. It's not really something we would call mathematics even, right? I mean, if you think about the highest level math class in many schools is some sort of, you know, AP calculus class, which is really a class about learning to do calculations. It's not really learning to do proofs or to think about things in rigorous ways that are intricate. And so I think until I got to be an undergraduate, I didn't really have a good sense of what university level mathematics was. So I think it wasn't until I was an undergraduate that I really thought that I wanted to focus on math.
Makes sense. How has math changed the way you think?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, it's hard to know, right? I mean, I'm not sure how aware we all are our own thought. The trajectories of our own thought processes. But certainly, I think, you know, one way that we hope that math changes how we think is teaching us to be careful and cautious in our reasoning and, you know, not make sort of unsupported leaps. There's one important lesson I think that math has to offer, which is, right, so if you're a math student at CMU, I think, there should be at least one point in your class when you've seen your math professor be wrong about something.
Right.
Right. And I think this is an important lesson, right? So one thing I like about math is that there's no hiding from being wrong. And, right, a mistake is a mistake. And when something is not true, it's not true and everybody can see it. And one thing that this should remind us of is that there is such a thing as really being wrong and anybody can be wrong. So it suggests sort of a caution about appeals to authority, right? So just because somebody's a professor or an expert or whatever, everybody can make mistakes.
Right.
And somehow, as a student, you can see those mistakes, right? And so I think it reminds us of the power of thought, right? That you, as a thinking student, can see the professor making a mistake and can see that they made a mistake, and you can be right about that.
Right.
And somehow, so this is something that's really appealing about mathematics is that it doesn't depend on hardly at all on appeals to the authority of the, you know, the leaders of the field, right? That any person can who has experience can sort of work through and see whether something is actually true, whether a proof is correct, whether somebody's made a mistake, So I think that there's some value in that lesson more generally. That in particular for all of us, we should remember that being wrong is a real thing.
Right.
And sometimes it's us that are wrong. Yeah.
Some of us more often than others. But
it's a real thing in that, you know, just being an expert on something doesn't mean that you can't be wrong about it. And we should always remember this about ourselves.
Right. Yeah. Have you ever submitted a paper and had like a big mistake pointed out to you or anything of that kind?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So after submitting a paper, I'm not sure about that, but certainly, I've written things down that I thought were right, and then later, you know, realized I had some problem with.
Yeah.
So thinking of good examples right now, but definitely this is something that happens, and it happens to everybody.
Right. What are you working on now? Is there a problem that you can explain in not too long?
Okay, well, one thing I can do is I can explain sort of in more detail how this the mathematics of these gerrymandering problems works, so, since I just touched on. So the basic, there the problem was how to sample, like how to generate good random samples from some from a set of geometric partitions of a shape. For example, that might be a state, and we want to divide that state into, let's say, 10 regions, all of which have roughly equal population, all of which are connected. And maybe we have some additional constraint that the shapes have to be nice in some way, like they can't, maybe the perimeter of the shapes can't be too large or something like that. And so how can I generate a random sample from this? So the basic tool here that gets used for a lot of problems like this is called a Markov chain. And a Markov chain is basically a random walk around any space. So for example, if you're, you know, in a city with a street grid, and you carry out a procedure where you, at every intersection, you roll a four-sided die to decide which direction to walk in. You keep doing this over and over again so that you're taking a random walk around the city. That random walk that you're carrying out would be a Markov chain on the locations in the city, right? So over time, you would travel around the city. And if you did this for long enough, you would eventually be at an essentially random point of the city. And so the crucial point, the crucial property of a Markov chain, the reason why, so what the name means in mathematics is that every step, what you decide to do next depends only on where you are and not where you right. came from, right? So for example, every time you get to an intersection, you roll a die and you can go in any direction, and it doesn't depend on sort of, you know, what you did 10 steps ago. Okay, and in any case, so a random walk like this can be done not just on a space like city streets, but on any space that you can define. And so what you can do for a problem like the districting problem is define a space which is the set of all possible partitions of the state into 10 regions of roughly equal population, which are nice in shape. So that's a huge space of possibilities, right? So to keep it from being infinite, let's imagine that the districts, so the partition classes, are built out of discrete building blocks. So maybe each one is a collection of voting precincts or something like that.
Right.
So that essentially we're partitioning a planar graph. And how do we define a random walk around this space? Well, you can imagine moving from one districting to another by making a small change to it. Like maybe I find a voting precinct on the boundary of two districts, and I change which of those two districts it belongs to. And if I do that, then I've taken one step. I move from one choice of how to partition the state to another. And if I made that choice randomly, so if I had randomly chosen which precinct to change the membership of, then I would have taken a random step in this space.
Right.
And then by making a sequence of steps like this over and over again, I'm walking through this space of possible districts of the state, just like you're walking around the city if you're rolling this die at every intersection. And also just like that, if I do this for long enough, I'll reach what's called a stationary, I'll become close to what's called a stationary distribution, where my location is random, and approximately it's random with a specific distribution that I can calculate.
Right.
And so it lets me get a handle on how to generate these random samples talking about. But there are all sorts of theoretical challenges with using Markov chains in a context like this. So, you know, one thing that I alluded to just now is that if I run this chain for long enough, for example, if I walk around the city for long enough, I'm at an essentially random location. Mm-hmm. And we know that that's true, but what we don't know in many cases is how long you have to do the walk for. So for the city, if I really have something like a square grid, on an example like this, you can prove something about what's called the mixing time, which is how long you have to run the walk before you're essentially random. But for the case of a districting problem, we don't know the mixing time rigorously. And right. so we don't know how long you have to run. We know that in principle, if I ran it for long enough, I would be in an approximately random state. But we don't actually know exactly how long that would take. And in particular, it could take exponentially long in the size of the state. What we do for this problem is we develop statistical techniques that allow us to make rigorous statements about whether districtings are outliers without answering this question of how long you would have to run to mix.
Yeah.
But this question of the mixing time of the chain is itself very interesting. And so this is one thing that we're thinking about now, is what we can say about generating random samples by getting at this question of how long you have to run, you know, through this districting space randomly before you're essentially at a random place. And again, the analogy is how long do you have to walk around this city until you're at essentially a random place?
Cool. Do you ever spend any time on hard problems, like problems that haven't been solved for a long period of time?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, in some sense, certainly almost everything we work on is problems that haven't been solved. And yeah, sometimes it's problems that haven't been solved for a long time where you think there's a lot of interest. And yeah, I mean, it's important to bounce these problems around. Otherwise, they would never get solved.
Right.
So yeah, that's definitely something that we thought. Yeah, I mean, it's a balance, right? Sometimes you're thinking about something that, you know, just caught your interest, and sometimes you're thinking about some, you know, big old problem that you've been wanting to solve for a long time.
Nice. What's your Erdős number?
Oh, good question. My Erdős number is two, I guess. Yeah, so I have a co-author that was a co-author of Erdős.
Nice. For people who don't know, Erdős number is like your degrees of separation from Paul Erdős, who is a prolific mathematician, published like 1,700 papers or something. And if you published a paper with him, your number's one. And if you published a paper with someone who published a paper with him, your number's two, so on and so forth. And that's just something mathematicians brag about.
That's right.
Who are some of your who are some of the people you look up to in math, like an idol or a role model?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know. So, I think So, one thing that I think is really impressive is the big historical advances that were made at a time when our understanding of math was much more in its infancy. So if you think about, right, the sort of the intellectual leaps that were made, for example, by the first discoverers of calculus, somehow, in some sense, what that took, it's not clear that sort of anything that we do now requires as much of an intellectual leap as what happened then, in part because mathematics itself, in some sense, didn't exist, right? We didn't really have a rigorous framework in which we, could develop mathematical theories. And so breakthroughs like that, I think are really quite, I think a lot about these historical examples of, what it took for somebody to break out of, the paradigm they were in and really get to, generate a lot of insight when there wasn't a good framework for doing that.
Right.
In some sense, now we've built up this whole intellectual system, which allows us to much more efficiently, develop insight about problems. And I think somehow, the really impressive thing is that we were kind of able to do this before we had that.
Right.
But it was much harder.
How do you foster interest in math among your students or younger mathematicians?
Question. I'm not sure I know the right answer to this. I think, what I hope that I do is project excitement about math, and that it's this interesting and fun thing that should captivate us. But maybe that's a question for you, though. But, what is exciting students today about math?
Well, I think I'm different than most people. I like to state problems, and other people have a lot of trouble with this. But I'll see something on TV or watch a YouTube video, or the canonical example was I was been looking at the bathroom tiling, and I was thinking, how many ways could you tile an M by M rectangle such that rotations and reflections are the same? And so that's a story that my friends always tell about me figuring out a problem to solve. So I just see math and everyday stuff, and I'm like, maybe this is an interesting problem, and some amount of the time it is. Maybe 80% of the time it's either been solved or it's not that interesting. But some of the time it comes up with some pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, this is certainly true for research math also, that the vast majority of problems we work on, we either we don't solve, right?
Right.
Or and somehow, right? The joke is, we're failing to solve problems 100% of the time, but 100% isn't exactly right. There's a slight error.
Right.
100%, and that error is where everything happens, right? Every once in a while, we succeed. Yeah.
If you can't solve something and you need someone who you think is, I won't say smarter, but more advanced than you, is there someone specific you like to bounce ideas off of?
So I don't know if most people have a person that they take problems to when they're stuck on. But there's this thing that we talked about before. Sometimes, there's some problem where there's some particular subject matter that you think might be relevant.
Right.
And so then you might ask somebody in that field, right? Is there some standard technique for this? Is there, and so certainly people do that, but then who you're asking depends on what kind of,
right.
What kind of problem you're thinking about.
Would you say your focus is on solving problems or building mathematical theory?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, ideally, we're sometimes doing both, but I think, you know, I think for me, somehow, the day-to-day fun of math comes from solving problems.
Right.
But I like to solve problems where, for me, there's some, you know, bigger story about how they fit into, you know, what we're learning about.
Right.
How things work.
Have you been a professor long enough that you've seen some of your students, like, come and go into the, like, research fields of math as a professor or similar stuff?
Yeah. I have a graduate student who's a faculty member at Auburn University. And yeah, this is the fun thing as a faculty member. You see, yeah, you have graduate students come through and then they go on and they have their own careers. Yeah. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the idea of the book by Paul Erdős?
Yes, I am.
Do you feel like you've written any proofs that would make it into the book?
Ooh, I don't know. I feel like people shouldn't put their own proofs in the book. That's for somebody else to do.
For sure. For those who are listening, the book is an idea by Paul Erdős, and it's like all the world's most beautiful proofs are in there, and mathematicians just, if they're lucky, they get a little glimpse at it, and they get to write it down. And Paul Erdős would say, you don't have to believe in God, but you have to believe in the book.
Yeah, that's right. The idea is that somehow there's this collection of beautiful proofs, and we're trying to find them. It almost reminds me of you know, Michelangelo would supposedly say that he could already, you know, the statue was already in the marble, right? The
right.
Sculpture. And he was just removing the excess marble around it. It was already there. He was just revealing it. So yeah, similar sort of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have kids?
I do, yeah.
Have you tried to teach some math to your kids, or how have you tried to inspire people of a much younger audience than your students?
Yeah, so I think for kids, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that math comes up, but I mean, one really simple way of, you know, engaging with math with kids is with, you know, various types of games, right? Like,
right.
Even tic-tac-toe, right, for young kids is very mathematical, right? It's your first experience with a case study. It's trying to understand, right? Can I always beat the others in that tic-tac-toe?
Right.
And then there's all sorts of variations you can put in tic-tac-toe, right? You can try to look at 4x4 tic-tac-toe. Is that the same? What about, you know, higher dimensions, right? You can
right.
draw a few tic-tac-toe boards so that you're really playing on a cube. And yeah, I think that's a fun way of introducing other concepts, you know, introducing sort of mathematical thinking younger kids. I mean, yeah, so at some point a while ago, I taught a program for middle schoolers over the summer. And there, the topic that that I used sort of as this vehicle to explore math was cryptography. So we learned about different encryption methods, you know, matrix ciphers, and and you learn modular arithmetic, and then, you know, you learn public key cryptography, which introduces you to prime numbers and things like that. And so, yeah, that's I think a really fun way to engage with medical topics for older kids. Yeah.
Does math run in your family? Like, was your dad interested in math, or anyone you looked up to?
Yeah, I think it's definitely. A lot of people can say that, me included, can, you know, look in their family and see some people that had, you know, a lot of interest in math. But I'd say there's also plenty of people that don't have that. And
yeah, for
and,
sure.
And sort of at the top of their field, and wouldn't point to any family members that
right.
For whom math was an important part of their life. So I think both of these things are really well represented in the.
That makes sense. Yeah, so my dad and grandfather both have a math degree, and so it seems that every every like generation has a like every I don't know two or maybe six people one of them has studied, which is I think really bizarre.
That's unusual, especially getting that far back in time. Math degrees weren't so common, right?
Yeah, right. So we're a much less famous Bernoulli family. And the Bernoullis were this famous family of mathematicians. You've been listening to Pandemonium. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WICT or Carnegie Mellon University. Email comments or questions to WRCT Public Affairs, PA@WRCT.org. Thanks for listening to
WRCT Pittsburgh.
These are the sounds of a dinner. A dinner that almost didn't happen. A dinner now served, thanks to people like you. Due to COVID-19, 17 million more Americans may face hunger. Feeding America is helping our neighbors in need. And if you're able, you can too. Donations are being accepted at feedingamerica.org/coronavirus. Brought to you by the Ad Council and Feeding America, 200 food banks strong.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
time sadness. I just wanted you to know that baby, you're the best. I got my red dress on tonight, dancing in the dark in the pale moonlight. Done my hair up real big, beauty queen style, high heels off, I'm feeling alive.
If you give a little more than you take, and if you try to fix more than you break, if you're the kind who takes the time to help a stranger in the rain, there's a place for people like you. If you stand up for those down on their knees and lend a voice to those who cannot speak, if you shine a little light, give sight to the ones who've lost their way, there's a place for people like you. I've heard up there the streets are made of gold.
Turn it up, turn it up, turn it up, turn it up.
And when you get there, there's a hand to hold. I believe when your days down here are through, there's a place up there for people like you. If
you walk around with your heart on your sleeve, and if you're trying to be the change you wanna see, if you lay down your life for love so someone could be saved, there's a place for people like you.
Turn it up, turn it up, turn it up.
I've heard up there the streets are made of gold. And when you get there, there's a hand to hold. I believe when your days down here are through, there's a place up there for people like you.
said, are you ready? Take it.
Today, gone tomorrow. You might as well get what you want. So go on and live. Go on and live.
Tell it like it is.
Don't be ashamed. Let your conscience be your guide. No deep down inside, I believe you love me, so forget your foolish pride.
Don't lie to me.
If you are serious, don't play with my heart, makes me furious. But if you want me to love you, don't be ashamed, let your conscience be your guide. No, no deep down inside.
I found hope in the midst of an overwhelming situation.
I let go of trying to control things that I had no control over, and that helped me find peace of mind.
Alcoholism is a disease that can affect any family. Everyone suffers, but there is help and hope at Al-Anon Family Groups.
I was constantly stressed and worried. Now I approach each day with joy and gratitude.
In Al-Anon, families and friends of alcoholics find new ways to heal from the effects of a loved one's drinking.
Al-Anon gave me my life back. I'm a better father and husband.
Are you in an overwhelming situation because of someone else's drinking?
Al-Anon and Alateen can help.
Local and virtual meetings are available. Maybe one could work for you. For information, call 1-866-200-0033 or visit alanon.org/hope. If you talk,
they will hear you. We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy. So we show them how. And we tell them with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. Not just one time, but every chance we get. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids not only need to know the dangers and how to avoid them, they need to hear it often from you. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids and guide them through the challenges of growing up safe and healthy. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information about talking with your kids about underage use of alcohol and other drugs, visit underagedrinking.samhsa.gov. So talk, they hear you.
You can do it if you try. Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
It's dark in here, and the walls are closing in. I struck my last match, let it burn down till it bit my fingertips. And I remember the light. Just a flash and then an ember. And a whisper of smoke curling up into the air and disappearing. It's dark in here, and the air is getting. My canary sang his last song, a pretty little tune. It echoes on and on and on inside my ear. It was a song of hope. It was a song of redemption. And that little yellow bird, with his last dying word, he sang forgiveness. And I'm sorry that I spent our time hiding underground. Pulls me down here, this familiar deep dark cavern. Keep repeating the same pattern. You above and me below. I say goodbye before I my last breath. At last I see the light.
smoggy eyes.